WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Guns are becoming frighteningly common in America. So is murder. Over the past 2 years, guns have killed 60,000 Americans, more than the number of American soldiers killed in the Vietnam War. My guest Eric Larson is writing a book about the domestic gun trade. His article, The Story of a Gun, is the cover story of The Atlantic magazine's January issue. It traces how a 16-year-old bought a semi-automatic handgun at a Virginia store, hid it in his backpack with hundreds of rounds of ammunition, and took it to the Atlantic Shores Christian School in Virginia Beach, where he fired 15 rounds, killing one teacher and wounding another. Larson says this story illustrates the de facto conspiracy of gun dealers, manufacturers, marketers, and federal regulators, a conspiracy which makes guns too easy to come by. Larson told me about the gun the underage youth of his story managed to buy.
The specific gun is called a Cobray M11-9, and it is a semi-automatic version of a legendary, perhaps I should say notorious, submachine gun created in the 60s, specifically for use by guerrilla forces and commando forces. The initial weapon, and this is part of the reason that I found this such an astonishing story, was that, you know, here was a gun devised specifically to kill as many people as possible in as short an amount of time, that for various reasons never really was a big hit with police departments or the military. And yet it attained this incredible reputation and became, in fact, the weapon of choice among drug dealers and gangs throughout the late 70s and early 80s. Not just that gun, but other variations of it made by subsequent owners of the company.
You fired it on a target range. What did it feel like?
This is where the whole gun issue really gets kind of clarified for me. And this may sound strange. Shooting that gun on the gun range, I got to say, was a blast. No apologies. Shooting a gun, and I've subsequently learned to shoot a handgun, is fun. I mean, it's this strange experience where you stand there and you blast away with this semi-automatic weapon that at one time was designed to kill as many people as possible, and you just fire at these targets and the dirt flies and so forth, and it's somehow it's very removed from the streets. It's just fun. It's kind of exciting. It's this big adrenaline rush.
Well, the person who bought the gun and murdered the teacher was underage. How did he get a semi-automatic gun?
He got that gun through the means that is really the primary means by which guns are diverted from the legitimate distribution channels, so-called legitimate distribution channels, to illegal users, to the bad guys, to the kids who use them in the cities. And that is a so-called straw man purchase. That's where a qualified buyer, a buyer who is qualified by federal or local regulations to buy that gun, acquires it and then gives it or sells it to an unqualified buyer. In this case, a kid. I mean, he was, I believe, if I'm recalling this correctly, 15 at the time he actually acquired the weapon.
So there was someone who bought it for him in the store. But
right.
But the way you describe it, it sounded like the actual firearms dealer probably saw what was happening.
Well, yeah, and here, I necessarily have to be a little discreet because you have to look at the court record very carefully, and you have to understand the nature of the transaction in considerable detail to reach that conclusion. However, I should say also that a jury did reach that conclusion in a liability suit, in a civil liability suit, awarded $100,000 to the family of the dead teacher. The nature of that transaction was very suspicious. Here was a guy who goes into the gun store with a child, and this child is doing all the shopping, is asking some very knowledgeable, detailed questions about guns, and is clearly the guiding shopper in this transaction. And nonetheless, the dealer sold the gun to the older cousin.
You say a none-of-my-business attitude prevails in the gun industry. What do you mean by that?
Well, by that I mean that you know, companies, gun makers, gun dealers, they can very actively promote and market guns as being deadly weapons, as being ideal for self-defense. Companies can specifically design their weapons to be as lethal as possible. Ammunition makers will put full-page ads in gun magazines talking about wound channels and the kind of devastation that their particular bullet can wreak on the human body. And yet, when someone then uses, surprise, surprise, uses their wares to kill somebody, it's like, hey, it's not my responsibility. It's not my problem. It's guns don't kill, you know, people do.
Do you think it should be the responsibility or the problem of the gun industry?
It's too simple to say that it's not my problem. Again, you have to get fairly specific about it. When you look, for example, I examined a series of transactions made by this particular gun dealer in this case. And what I found is that, you know, in Virginia, all this gun dealer is required by federal law to do, to sell a gun to a kid, to an ostensibly qualified buyer, is have that buyer fill out something called a Form 4473, which is a form that simply indicates that this guy bought a handgun, and it asks 8 questions. You know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? Have you ever been judged mentally incompetent? Have you ever given up your U.S. citizenship? That kind of thing. But the problem is that this form is ideal for discharging responsibility. There is no effort on anybody's part to follow up on what is asked on that form. When that buyer fills it out, he's responsible for saying yes or no, and knows damn well that if he says yes to any of those questions, he's not going to get that gun. So what's he going to do? He's going to say no. And he's going to sign it, and that's the end of it. As far as the gun dealer is concerned, that's all he's got to do. As far as the federal regulators are concerned, that's all he's got to do. And I just think that that's not enough.
You applied to buy a gun last May. What was the process like for you?
Actually, I did not apply to buy a gun. I did something that I consider actually more significant in terms of what we see and read about every day. I became a licensed federal arms dealer. That is to say that I got my federal firearms license. I mean, believe me, I'm not selling guns, nor do I intend to. But I did that because I wanted to find out how easy it was to get that kind of a license. And I found out that it was incredibly easy. It was the easiest, far easier than getting my driver's license, believe me. I just paid my $30, filled out the form, and within 45 days, theoretically, I could have been in business.
What were you asked on the form?
Well, you know, the same questions. Was I ever convicted of this, that, and the other thing? Was I judged mentally incompetent? Other questions on the form were, you know, would my dealership be open to the public? And my answer was yes. If I open my dealership, it will be open to the public. Was it available for inspection by federal agents? And my answer was yes. Federal agents are welcome. Another requirement was that I would place the license in full public view in my place of business. And in fact, in my office, it is taped to the wall in full public view. Apart from that, there's really nothing that is else specified.
So the point you're making is that anybody could sell guns, basically.
Well, yeah, and furthermore, people do that. There are something like 236,000 federal firearms licensees, of whom, according to one interview I had at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, probably about half don't actually operate storefronts. which means that there's an awful lot of Mies out there who are empowered, depending on state and local regulations that might add certain rules, who are empowered to buy guns from distributors and sell them out of their homes.
Meanwhile, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which regulates the industry, you say they're very understaffed, that there are 400 inspectors for 425,000 licensed firearms dealers.
Yeah. Well, they are, first of all, I believe it's 400 inspectors for 236,000 or whatever it is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But, they just have that many inspectors. There's just an awful lot of work that needs to be done in terms of inspecting and tracking dealers that the ATF simply cannot do. And interestingly, when they do compliance, routine compliance inspections, these people find an awful lot of violations.
You went to gun shows, you read gun magazines, you examined gun culture. What did you find that really surprised you?
Well, one of the things that's most surprising, and I recommend this to anybody who wants kind of a scary kick on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, is to go visit a gun show. A gun show, yeah. I mean, you know you're there right away because, for example, I pulled up at one gun show in Frederick, Maryland, and it's not every day that you see a guy walking up to the door to this agricultural display building carrying an AR-15 slung over his shoulder. You know, it's just a really wild experience. And you go inside, and man, it's the gun culture in full view. There was a guy walking around with a gun slung over his shoulder with a sign stuck in the barrel saying, "For sale." You see, private sales are a big thing. Private sales are utterly unregulated by the federal government. You have to fill out the Form 4473 when you buy a gun from a dealer. But then if you turn around and want to sell that to your neighbor, there's no paperwork required whatsoever. So these people come to these gun shows to sell their own weapons, and it's really a riot. One guy had a whole, literally a billboard on his back saying what guns he had to offer, and the ones he'd already sold were crossed off.
Did people approach you about anything?
You mean to buy anything? Or?
Mm-hmm.
No, nobody came up to me and said, "Hey, you want to buy a gun?" But, the commerce was in the air. It was real interesting. I think one of the... one of the kind of most, the scariest, scary, I don't know, one of the shocking things was I saw a display, a video display from a company that makes fairly exotic ammunition, things that explode in the body and so forth. And this was a systematic effort to show how powerful their bullets were, working up to their most powerful. And what was on this video was the guy would sit there on his chair behind a table, and he would shoot these bullets into what is called a block of what's called ordnance gelatin, which is a gelatin compound, yellowish gelatin compound, designed specifically to emulate the behavior of human flesh on contact with a bullet, and to show the wound channel and the cavity and so forth. And I was standing there as a father and his son were watching this thing, and the kid couldn't have been more than, I don't know, like 8. And he was just watching it absolutely rapt. And there was his father, too. And it was like this big father and son thing, watching all these bullets destroy emulated human flesh. It was a terrific outing for a Sunday afternoon, you know?
Yeah. You point out that sometimes guns... get more popular after films that feature that gun. For instance, the Smith & Wesson became more popular after Dirty Harry.
Right.
What are you seeing now in terms of the influence of movies or TV on guns?
Well, it hasn't subsided. I mean, this has been a constant feature of the gun culture and its relationship to Hollywood since the 70s. I mean, McHugh, a movie starring John Wayne, really virtually put the Ingram submachine gun, which is the forerunner of the gun I write about, really put that on the map. I couldn't imagine better advertising for a gun than that particular movie. Miami Vice did the same for the Ingram and for other weapons. I don't want to think about what Lethal Weapon has done for the Beretta, which is what Mel Gibson virtually marries in each film. I think more more shocking even than that is that after a major incident involving a homicide, or as is typically the case, a multiple homicide involving a particular firearm, the price of that firearm very often goes up. After the Stockton schoolyard shootings, the price of the price of the weapon used there, and I believe it was an AK-47 or an SKS version, which is a semi-automatic version of it, soared, absolutely soared. Same with the rifle used by Lee Harvey Oswald to assassinate John F. Kennedy. The value of that gun rose incredibly.
What does the price go up?
Demand. I mean, that is the great question, is what is it about America that when a bunch of school kids are mowed down in a Stockton, California schoolyard, that the weapon that did it becomes a hot prospect, a hot commodity? I'm frankly at a loss. I'm disturbed by it, but I can't really explain it.
I guess it becomes like a celebrity gun.
Yeah. You know, very much the same as when the Smith & Wesson Model 29 was used by Dirty Harry. It became a hot thing to have. It makes you feel bad, I guess. You know, it makes you feel like you're powerful, and it's something to bring out over for conversation while the fire is burning bright in your home or something. I don't know.
My guest is Eric Larson. He's writing a book on the gun trade in America. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Eric Larson. His article about guns is in this month's Atlantic Magazine. You're writing a book about guns now.
Yeah.
Are you more cognizant about the possibility of guns than you ever were before? Do you walk down the street looking at people thinking, I wonder which one of these guys has a gun?
I do, actually. I know now, for example, where people tend to carry guns. And
where?
Well, guys, one of the fashions is to carry it in the small of the back in a belt, in the belt, perhaps in a holster, perhaps not. And so you always look to see how that prints on a jacket. For example, recently my local liquor store has become very aware of security for reasons I'm not quite sure of, but they installed, you know, these big fences and so forth. And now they have a security guy who walks around with he's the only guy in the place with his shirt untucked. And I watched him real closely one day, and I realized this guy's got a gun tucked into the back of his belt. I also look very carefully at women who are wearing so-called fanny packs. That's become the mode of choice for civilians who want to carry a weapon.
Do you own a gun?
No, I don't own a gun. But I have to say, you know, I consider myself. I get really offended when people automatically try to fit me into a category and say, "Oh, well, because you're the media, you're anti-gun," or someone else perhaps to at some point argue that I'm pro-gun. I think that does a major disservice to most of the Americans out there who have guns and keep them for self-defense and who are truly responsible, safe, concerned owners of those weapons. But when I think about myself owning a gun, I don't know. I think that I might, depending on my circumstances. If I lived way out in a rural area, and if I didn't have two small kids, and you know, there were there was a motorcycle gang that was known to pass by on the road out front, yeah, maybe I would. You never really can tell until you're in that situation, I think. You know, I've been talking a lot to women over the last couple of weeks for something else about why they own guns and why they've taken a shooting course. And it's very compelling to hear these very reasonable, sane women, very concerned, often petrified of guns before they first picked one up, saying that, yes, they now carry a gun, and they appreciate how deadly they are. But they're going to carry it because they don't want to be a victim. So I'm, you know, my views are evolving. I don't know. I cannot say that at some point I would not buy a gun. Mm-hmm. I like to think that I won't be driven to that point, and that I never will. The one thing I can say with certainty is that with two small kids, I will not own a gun.
Do you think in the gun literature there's the assumption or the knowledge that some of the people who are reading this are killers?
I I don't see how anybody who is in the business, and again, this cuts to this matter of responsibility versus irresponsibility. I don't see how anybody in the business can not know and fully expect that some of the readers and buyers are killers, psychos, rapists, and otherwise. I mean, it kind of goes with the territory. Look, you know, we're talking about an industry that just in day-to-day operation has to take some very bizarre operating steps to stay in business. You walk into a gun store, like this gun store down in Virginia, first thing you notice is the tank traps in the sidewalk out front, which were put there because somebody a couple years ago had driven a dump truck through the display windows in order to get at the guns. Second thing you notice is that the doorway's been reinforced, that there's a herringbone steel grate across the door, across the windows, and that there's a gigantic Pepsi machine placed deliberately right next to the lock side of the door so that nobody can get through all those other defenses and reach behind and open the door. Most striking is the clerks at the counter, who are both wearing large bore revolvers or high caliber pistols. I mean, this is an industry that just to operate on a daily basis takes precautions that probably the Secret Service doesn't even take, at least not as visibly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Eric Larson's article, The Story of a Gun, is in this month's Atlantic Magazine. Larson joined us last month to discuss his book about direct mail marketing called The Naked Consumer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.